This installment of our podcast, The Forgetting, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's, includes an interview with Kim Campbell, the wife of country music legend Glen Campbell. It was recorded on January 10th, 2017, 7 months before Glen Campbell died from complications related to Alzheimer's disease. He was 81.
This is The Forgetting.
The filter allows you to say what everyone else wants to say, but they can't because they're afraid to. So I've become a parody of my favorite comedian, the genius Larry David. I'm talking to these people, friends of mine, and this other person I didn't know from Harvard, and all of a sudden my attention's drawn to this guy like 4 feet away, and it's getting louder and louder. Finally, I broke away, went up to this perfect stranger and said, "Would you shut the fuck up?" And this is at Harvard, the club. And again, you heard the uh-oh.
I never say I put my husband in long-term care or I placed him in a memory support community. I say our family joined a memory support community because it's for the whole family.
Right.
In my community, too, those families were all going through this together, and we all need each other.
From WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and my brownstone apartment in Brooklyn, New York, this is The Forgetting, a podcast about dementia. I'm David Shank, author of the book The Forgetting, and senior advisor to an international research consortium called Cure Alzheimer's Fund, which helps make this podcast possible. And with me, as always, always, is my friend and my brother and my co-host, Greg O'Brien. No relation. The brother part's just, you know.
We're separated at birth.
The informal love thing.
We're separated author, at birth.
Greg is author of On Pluto, the incredible book On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. Read that right after you read mine. His book has that subtitle because Greg has early onset Alzheimer's, as many of you already know, and he is committed to reporting his experience for as long as he possibly can. That's why this podcast exists. Greg, hi, how are you feeling today?
I'm feeling okay. You know, we always talk about the sense of humor because the Irish side of me that keeps me going. So you're probably going to cut this because you won't have the nerve to run it. But, you know, for the podcast, they asked me for a photo of me. And I've always said, David, that you're a lot brighter and more accomplished than I am, but I'm just better looking. And when you say that about someone in dementia, that should give you cause to look in the mirror. But so I heard they asked me for a photo, but they wanted an artist rendering of you. Is that anywhere near, or is that just in my mind?
Your mind is
hallucinating.
Your sense of humor is way up there. I want to tell people that yesterday or maybe the day before we were trading emails, and I decided to throw something pretty abstract at you, and you absolutely caught it. It was
what was it?
It was. I forget actually the details now, but you, the idea was, you said that you had just done something, an hour had gone by. We were waiting to hear back from someone. And I said, well, let's give that person an hour. And you said, you came back to me in almost exactly an hour later and said, you said, it's been an hour. So, you know, we should maybe move forward with the other, you know, with plan B. And I said, Greg, it's been 2 months since you last emailed me. I don't know what you're... I wanted to... I've never done that before, and I never
loved
do it to anyone else.
Thank you for reminding me, but...
with dementia,
You have to lap your ass off in this disease, if you could say that.
But here's the important part. Here's the punchline. It would be a cruel thing to do to someone who had to have no chance of getting that joke or who would perceive that as some sort of, you know, attack on their senses. But, of course, you rolled right with it. So that tells me that for all of your for all of your disabilities that are creeping in, you're still operating at a very high level of
humor
of cognitive functioning. Humor is for people who don't know this, humor is actually extremely, extremely high level. It's arguably one of the highest, if not the highest level of cognitive functioning, because it's all about abstract ideas, built on abstract ideas. If you can't get the joke, you know, the whole idea of a joke is that you're expecting something, but then it goes in a different direction, and you have to realize that that's not a mistake. It's an, you know, it was done purposefully, so that's why you laugh, and that's why it's funny, and you kind of correct it in your mind, and you were able to. I had the guts to throw that at you, and I hoped it wouldn't cause any problems, and it didn't. You ruled right with it.
Well, I forgot what I said, but you know, at some point, we should talk about how humor is contrasted with, in this disease, loss of filter, because the two are connected. Sometimes I can be funny, and you know, my daughter always says, "Daddy, there's a thin line between caring and creepy, and you cross that line every day." So I'm just saying.
And is that, would you say that's gotten worse in over the last year or two?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many people who will now say, well, what Greg meant to say was. And
right.
It you become more potty mouth. And because the filter, you know how this works more than me, allows you to say what everyone else wants to say, but they can't because they're afraid to. So I become a parody of my favorite comedian, the genius Larry David. I love that man. And I so love Larry David because he says what we all want to say. And in Alzheimer's, we kind of become Larry Davids.
Right. The uncensored id, I think it is.
Yeah.
So
I want to meet him at some point, if you have any connections, and tell him how he keeps me laughing.
We'll try to get him on as a guest. Why not?
Oh, God, that would be great.
Why not go for it? So Greg, let's stay on this for a second. So how do you think about that? Because obviously at a certain point, you won't have really much control over this, or maybe necessarily even awareness over this. And that's got to be the scariest thing about this disease, is knowing, you know, that you're going to lose control and that you're also going to lose awareness. And I wonder how you think about yourself losing your filter. And you know, it may be kind of, you know, in check now, and you help keep it in check with your friends and your family. But how do you think about that going forward, about what that's going to be like?
Well, it's more in check with people I don't know, because something inside says bad dog, bad dog. But you're tired of fighting yourself. So the loss of filter is more around my family. And it's like, holy shit, he said that? And there'll be, I don't know if I could use that word, but Sean can edit it out. And sometimes people laugh. They go, I wish I could say that. But you get confused, and the loss of filter can affect your bodily functions and your mind. I just became a grandfather, and I had wrote about it earlier that I had ambivalent feelings about that, because this child really won't know who I was when I was myself. But I was excited about being a grandfather, but sad. And I didn't confide that in anyone, my wife and kids, but with a close friend, you know, they asked me about it. And I said, I just have to, they said, you seem a little melancholy. And I said, yeah. And I said, why? And so I never thought I'd get to hold a grandchild. And on Christmas night in Baltimore, I got to hold my Adeline, my daughter Colleen's first child. And anyone who's on Facebook, if they want to look, we took a picture of it. But getting down, and this is the whole thing where with the filter. So you walk into a room and someone says, well, he looks good, or he sounded good. And then there's what happens behind the scenes. On the way, I'll try to get to the point here. On the way down to Baltimore, Christmas Eve, we went through Homeland Security, and the airport really screws me up. And it's just a lot of noise, a lot of confusion, and people asking you strange questions and telling you to take your clothes off. And so it was the part of, I got all my stuff in a ball and was kind of pushing it through. And that's what I do. I wrap all my crap up in a ball, which you're not supposed to do because I'm afraid it's going to get lost in that tunnel. And then I walk through. And the next thing I know, I see one of my wife's shoes flying out. And I'm in my mind took me back to body parts. I'm going, oh, my God, she must have gone. I don't know why I thought this. She must be in the tunnel. She kicked her shoe off. And I said, when did she jump in? This is what happens in this disease. When did she kick her shoe off? So I'm upset. The shoe comes flying out. And then I see her walking without a shoe behind me on the other side. And I'm by the, we're both through now. And I retrieved the shoe. And you know when you're upset at one of your children because you think they're lost or something happened, and then you get angry when you realize everything's okay? It was a Sperry Topsider. And I threw it at her. This is with freaking Homeland Security around. And then you could hear my son Connor go, uh-oh, what an asshole. He said it in loving terms, but I threw a... So he sends an email to Colleen that says, we're so looking forward to come down. The Christmas spirit is upon us. We're so excited about seeing Adeline. We're just so at peace. And by the way, Dad just threw a shoe at Mom.
So I think what you're saying is you are Larry David. You've already achieved that.
No, I've become, and I know others in Alzheimer's, we've become Larry David. And there are all sorts of examples of it, but he's my hero. I watch him all the time.
Yeah. So, but do you worry about going forward about not, I mean, I guess this is kind of obvious, or tell me if I'm wrong, but your family at a certain point won't be comfortable having you around strangers because of the things you might say, or maybe you'll be embarrassed about
they're not now. And there are times we'll go out in public, and I call them the wardens. My wife or family members or close friends will be near me. And I don't know if I told you this before, and Sean can check it, but I went to an event at the Swanky Harvard Club in Boston. It was a cure Alzheimer's function, and Rudy Tanzi, another hero of mine, was speaking, and they had a, you might have even been there. I think you were. And
maybe.
They had a reception upstairs after, and I can't process noise, and the brain, and maybe you could explain it better than me, just can't process that noise, and it seems louder and more confusing than it is. And so there was this one guy who was talking, probably not loud, but in my mind he was screaming, and it becomes like the stabbing sounds in Psycho, you know, that the brain just, and so I'm really pissed. So I'm going to use a bad word here, and I'm just going to tell you, and then you could, you know, exit it out or whatever you call
it. Go for it.
So I'm talking to these people, friends of mine, and this other person I didn't know from Harvard, and all of a sudden my attention's drawn to this guy, like, 4 feet away, and it's getting louder and louder. Finally, I broke away, went up to this perfect stranger and said, would you shut the fuck up? And this is at Harvard, the club. And again, you heard the uh-oh. And so I'm hearing that a lot now. So my friends had been there before in this nightmare. They pulled me away. Some guy, friend of mine, went up and apologized, and they took me downstairs and calmed me down and said, you just stay here for a while. And so then I went back up and felt I had to apologize. And I did, but Larry David was going through my mind. And by the time I was through, I wanted to say, but you were so fucking loud. That was very obnoxious. But I didn't say that.
David, we have your guest on the phone.
Super. Well,
hi,
joining
us. Hi, I'm trying to talk. Can you hear me?
I can. Yeah. Let me tell everyone who this is. Kim Campbell is Glenn Campbell's wife. Many of you have probably already seen the fantastic documentary I'll Be Me, which is about Glenn Campbell and his Alzheimer's disease and the decision, the brave decision of his family to document so much of the Alzheimer's, of Glenn's Alzheimer's on camera for the public. And that's been such a great gift to all of us to show the world what this disease really looks like. And I want to ask you about your decision years ago now to let those cameras come into your life and share to share what you and Glenn were going through for the world.
Sure. It was really Glenn's decision. We were all set to go out on a tour to promote his new album, and we got the diagnosis of Alzheimer's. And we had to sit down and have a meeting with his managers and record producers and musical directors, the whole team, to figure out, you know, should we cancel the tour, should we keep going? And Glenn said, I feel fine. I'm going to go out there and do what I love to do. And, you know, we had our kids traveling with us. He wanted to do that with them. And he just didn't see any reason why he shouldn't go out there and continue living his life. And I said, you know, well, what's going to happen if you mess up on stage or, you know, forget the lyrics to songs or keep repeating yourself or something else that happens? We didn't really know, you know, what we were facing when we got the diagnosis, how the disease would manifest. But he said, I'll just tell everybody I got Alzheimer's. And, you know, that's his nature, to be open and honest. And really what it did was invite people to ask questions. And it helped remove the stigma of the disease. And it invited them to offer to help us any way they could, you know, by being open and honest about it. So I'm really proud of him for doing that.
Hey, right. This is Greg. Kim, I've told you this before. Your husband, Glenn, who's another hero of mine, he just crushed the stereotype of Alzheimer's. And, you know, such an iconic singer. When I was a young man going to Arizona, University of Arizona, driving from New York, I'd listen to your husband's songs. He got me across the country, it's ironic because now, in watching how he fought, how he spoke up, in the beautiful film that you did and Glenn did and your family and you know, directors and producers Trevor Albert and James Keesh. Just helped me keep the fight up. So Glenn is had an everlasting impact on me, and I want to thank you publicly for that.
Well, thank you. That's so good to hear. I appreciate it.
Kim, how did you feel about Glenn's decision? Were you as optimistic and easygoing about it, or did you feel like, wow, this is going to be pretty terrifying to have recorded on camera?
All of that.
Yeah.
I definitely supported him in his decision, and you know, I felt like he was still functioning really well, and I was a little nervous. I was nervous about how the public would accept it. I didn't know if we would all of a sudden, you know, our ticket sales would plummet and no one would want to go see him. Maybe they would think it was too sad and they might want to remember him in his prime, in his heyday. But we just found it was absolutely the opposite. The The very first show we did after going public was sold out, standing room only. And from the time he walked on stage, it was just standing O after standing O after standing O. People really responded to his honesty and wanted to come out and root for him. James Keach always laughs and says he was like Rocky with a guitar, you know, battling this disease. And then I had no idea that there were 5.4 million Americans with Alzheimer's. So I guess, you know, people really felt like we were telling their story too, and they connected with us. And it was such a blessing to meet so many people struggling with the same illness. It really is a community, and we all lift each other up and encourage each other. It's a hard road, but it helps to have other people on the road with you.
Yeah, yeah. You broke so much new ground, and it was inspiring. And clearly, you connected with a lot of people who were dealing with the disease themselves and needed that validation and that connection. But you also connected with people who aren't yet connected with the disease personally, but they still feel the fear of it and experience the taboo of even talking about that fear. And I think you were able to help all of those people who know that it's coming, if not for them, then for someone in their lives, because it's just, there's so many people who end up dealing with this disease in one way or the other.
Right. If they don't have it themselves, they end up knowing someone who will have it in the future, and a family member or a friend. And it is the most feared disease. Everyone fears getting it. Caregivers, I really relate to caregivers around the country who are shouldering the responsibility of caring for someone with Alzheimer's, especially in the late stages. And in fact, I started a blog and lifestyle guide called careliving.org to encourage caregivers to take care of themselves while they care for the ones they love, because it's a really tough job in the later stages.
Yeah, that's so important. And the stress in the early stages too. I mean, you're right, physically it becomes so hard in the later stages, but also just the stress of losing the life that you know, and the beginnings of the person that you know, that's just incredible stress. And if the caregiver
stress
doesn't,
and depression is really the main thing that caregivers struggle with, because they love their their husband or their parent, and they're losing them bit by bit. So there's a lot of depression that goes with that.
Kim, aren't they also more inclined to get sick? I know the pressure on my wife, and you're dealing with, how do I take care of this change? Oh my God, look at what just happened. What about our finances? What about our kids? And then at the same time, in this disease, you face bankruptcy, which we're facing at some point. So
yeah, it just
grinds
stressful.
You down, right? I mean, you're a prime example. I mean, it just everyone thinks of they go, oh my God, the person with Alzheimer's, I feel so sorry, and that's wonderful that they do. But man, you should feel as sorry or as supportive of the caregiver.
Yeah, the caregiver ends up being the second victim of the disease. The depression causes them to neglect themselves. They don't end up visiting their doctors. They don't get enough sleep. They're stressed out, and I always say the Bible says a merry heart is like medicine. Like a good medicine, and when you're depressed, you do end up being more susceptible to all kinds of illnesses. So that's why it's so important for caregivers to keep a positive outlook, to continually read things, listen to things, be in support groups, try to do things that will lift them up out of it so that they don't get sick.
Kim, I found in this disease, and I know you walk it every day, your faith helps you through this. Talk a little bit about, in this disease, how your faith sustains you.
Well, it is, if it weren't for my faith, I don't know how I would have made it this far or how I would face what's coming next. But you know, I do suffer depression, but every morning when I wake up, I thank God for my blessings, and then I ask God to help me be a blessing. And I think the fact that I want to be a blessing to others gives me purpose. So, and I just have faith that, yes, it's a tragedy, but God's going to bring, you know, the Bible says God will work all things together for good for those that are called according to his purposes. So I think that, you know, when you look for the positive and the good in things, that you can find it. Even today with Glenn in the late stages of Alzheimer's, you know, I'm still able to hug my husband and to, we just share some sweet moments together. So I've just learned to focus on the good. And I think that's largely because of my faith.
Kim, you not so long ago made the decision to put Glenn into some sort of residential facility. Is that right?
Yes, yes. In fact, when I talk about it, I never say I put my husband in long-term care or I placed him in a memory support community. I say our family joined a memory support community because it's for the whole family.
Right,
right.
My community, too. Those families, we're all going through this together, and we all need each other. And a lot of times it ends up being offering a much better quality of life for people who have dementia if you're in a good one. And there are so many good ones around the country now. Otherwise, a lot of times someone with dementia ends up, you know, stuck in the back bedroom of someone's home with one caregiver each day and no stimulation and no socialization and no activities. So, every situation is different. Everyone has to judge it for themselves according to what options are available to them. But for us, it's just been a big blessing. So
yeah.
I love my community.
And here again, you've broken through a huge taboo, because I can't tell you the number of people who I spoke to when I was writing my book years ago who were either on one side or the other. But, you know, if they hadn't yet gotten to the stage, they said, well, I just, you know, I made that promise. I swore I would never, you know, put that person in a home. I put my father or mother or husband or wife in a home. I can't do that to them. And they just, you know, there's that burden of that feeling that if you don't take care of them for the entire disease, you're somehow letting them down. And you're saying that, no, actually, if you really want to take care of them, this becomes something at least to consider as part of the best way to take care of them.
Right. And not only is it sometimes the best situation, but financially, it's so expensive to have in-home, round-the-clock care. It ends up being more economical as well to be a part of a memory community. If you hire somebody at $25 an hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that's $18,000 a month. Who can afford that? And at some point, you know, for many of us, it gets to the point where you cannot do it alone. You have to have professional help. So it's just such a blessing that so many communities are being developed to provide, you know, all the needs and all the such good quality of life for people that are suffering from all different kinds of dementia and their families.
Kim, can I ask you where Glenn is in the disease now? And can you talk, you know, as much as you're comfortable about just a few of the details of kind of being in the late stages?
Sure. It seems like he's been in the late stage of stage six out of seven stages for the last few years. I did meet with his doctor the other day who said he would gauge it as stage 7B out of, I guess, A, B, C, D, E stage, you know, of the last stage.
Right.
He's healthy physically. He can walk well. He can't communicate verbally. It's mostly gibberish. Occasionally he'll get a short few words out, but it's not really like he's communicating any ideas. They're just random, you know, phrases. He doesn't understand a word anyone says to him. He eats well. There, you know, he's in the incontinence phase, so that's sad for me to see.
Right.
But I have to tell you, he's very content and cheerful, and he sings all the time. It's not lyrics that any of us understand, but it's and they're not known melodies. But he's got a song in his heart, and you can tell that he's enjoying singing. And occasionally he'll whistle or do Donald Duck. So
I bet he likes to listen to music as well.
He's got a great Donald Duck impersonation.
Yeah, he's always loved to do that. He can't participate in any of the activities that they have, but he really enjoys just sitting there with everyone. He feels like, you know, I think he just loves to be around people. He loves to hug people. So I'm very thankful that he's content. I mean, that makes me feel good.
It sounds like his personality, at least the personality that I've known just from the movie and from being a fan for years, is actually a lot of the essence of that is still there, that he's still that kind of, even though he's not really communicating in the same way, you're still getting that kind of that essence of Glenn that still kind of shines on. Is that fair enough?
That is very accurate. He has his same essence. It's like his spirit is still there. His mind isn't. He can't put things together or understand, you know.
So how do you try to communicate with him? Because obviously, you know, it's got to be frustrating to try to talk to him, and I'm sure you still do that anyway, but how do you think about communicating with him in a new way?
I just use the universal language of hugs, kisses, smile, touch. I put on music for him. I don't really know. It's hard to tell if he's hearing the music or not, because he doesn't seem to respond to it, but he makes his own music, you know. Yeah, that's it. Just smiles and hugs and affection.
Kim, one of the things that I've learned and my mother, who died of Alzheimer's, taught me, and it gets back to the faith realm, I don't trust my brain anymore, but I've learned through my faith to trust my heart, the place of the soul. And I believe that when we get sick, our bodies get sick, our minds get sick, that soul, that essence of who we are that I believe lasts forever, is intact. And you can find ways of connecting, which I know you have, with Glenn in the place of the soul. And I found that with my mother right before she died. I was in the nursing home, and she had that moment that sometimes happens before people die where she was just more alert. And, you know, she was 83 years old, and she didn't even know my name. And I went one night at 10 o'clock because she was very upset, I was told, and scared. And I held her hand, said, "Mom, sorry to wake you up." And she said, "No, Greg, I'm glad you're here." Well, that was the first time she could say my name in 6 months, and we held and we talked kind of the gibberish thing that you're talking about, and I waited until she fell asleep, kissed her on the forehead, and her little eyes popped open, and again, very clearly, speaking from her soul, not her mind, she said, "Greg, where are you going?" And I realized the moment was there. She was leaving, and I said, "Mom, I'm not going anywhere. We're riding this one out together." And I sat down, I held her hand, I waited till she fell asleep. I kissed her on the forehead, and she never woke up again. And so I always tell people what you're doing with Glenn, which I think is the other side of this disease. You guys have found that place of the soul through your faith, and I hope anyone who's listening is listening to you. God bless you for saying that.
Thank you. I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I will tell you, when Glenn was, he was still able to say a few short phrases, but he really had lost most of his communication skills, which is called aphasia. This was maybe 2 years ago, such a long journey. But he would look out at the trees out of the window at the memory care community, and sometimes he would just raise up his hands and say, "Thank you, Heavenly Father." And he couldn't say much else, but he could utter, "Thank you, Heavenly Father." And I just knew that he sensed God's presence, that God was walking through this with him, that he felt secure, he felt grateful, and he had peace. And that just blessed me so much.
That's so great.
Well, I hope everyone who hasn't seen the movie yet we'll get a chance to see it. And I imagine it's now available. Is it on Netflix or some other?
Yes, Netflix.
Okay, super. So that's one easy one.
Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me. It's much must watching. That's the wrong word, but you know what I mean, for everyone to see.
And not just once. I think it's the kind of, it lifts up your spirit, and there's so much great music on it. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that you want to see once and not come back to. It's a small miracle, that film.
Right. It sure was. And people can check out my blog, careliving.org, to keep abreast of our journey.
Kim, thank you so much for joining us today and spending some time talking to us. I hope we can have you back again soon. Thanks for everything you're doing, and best wishes to you and Glenn and the family as you face these final stages.
Honored that you're on, and we will never forget Glenn, let me tell you. The world will never forget him.
Indeed.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, Kim. Thanks.
That was pretty good.
Well, first I have to say, when we're talking to someone together, Greg, you as you always do in so many different contexts, you get my competitive hackles up because you're asking the smartest questions, and I'm sitting there thinking, well, how can I ask a smarter question than that, or how can I get some FaceTime, some audio time here? I need to kind of squeeze Greg out of his line of questioning. So you're right there. That was fun to do. And this was one of the original ideas. Sean knows, our producer knows, that this is one of my original dreams of the show, is that you would not only be the constant subject, but really the co-host and every bit the journalist that you have been in your life, and asking all sorts of, really insightful questions that get people talking. And so far that really seems to be working. I have to say, we've only had a few guests, but they really, really want to talk to you and us and share what they're going through. So
in this case, I think, as you know, I have a lot of background with the film and with Kim and her family. So a lot of it just comes from the gut. But do me a favor also, I don't have the experience you have on this, but if you want to cut in, once you do that, that tells me that you want to cut in. And I always tell people in interviews, because sometimes I'm not focused on the time, you're not going to hurt my feelings if you ever cut in. I'll take that as a cue. So just keep that in mind.
Have you ever felt that I've worried about your feelings before?
No, apparently not.
Yeah, I'm pretty... What I need, though, is, like, technically, I need to talk to Sean about getting, like, all sorts of master switches where we say that other people are doing the engineering, but I'm really kind of the all controller. And if I feel like turning you down, oh, too bad. We lost Greg for a few minutes. So I'll just talk. And oh, good. He's back.
Yeah.
But maybe not for long.
Yeah.
So
where'd you go, Greg? Would you get lost? Anyway, well, I was very happy that Kim not only agreed to do it, she just emailed me a couple times back, I am so happy to do this. So she's just a very busy woman. And the fact that, so I was telling Sean, we can get all stars around the country, you know, and you just tell me what you want me to do.
We're gonna get some really, there's so many fantastic people in this world. And this actually goes to another theme that we all experience when you're in the Alzheimer's world, whether from your vantage point or my vantage point, is that this disease brings out the best in people. It brings out the best as a caregiver, as a family member, as a friend, as a person. And one of the things that I experienced after my book came out, and this is many years ago now, but it really has stayed, it's been a constant experience, is people who aren't in this world, they think that it's just a very terrible and depressing place to be in, and why would I voluntarily spend so much time in this very sad, world? and you're not here voluntarily, so you have a different situation. But what I try to explain to people is that actually it's a very life-affirming place to be, because you get to talk to people about what really matters. You get to hear people pouring their hearts out, saying, you know, really being honest with themselves, and you get to see the best of people. And, you know, there's a lot of parts in this world where we see the worst of people, you know, the greediest and the grubbiest, and in this world you see the other side, and it's addicting, actually, speaking for myself.
Well, let me give you a compliment, and I hope we're still on the air and you find a way to use this, but my wife Mary Catherine, you know, it's tough for her, you know. First of all, I'm my father's son, so I'm a tough ass, stubborn, freaking Irishman, and I don't want to take help, but I need help, and so she's very upset with me. And she was, frankly, David, afraid to read your book, and she just finished it, and she was crying, she was laughing, she was reading parts of it to me. I've already read it, but of course I forgot it. That's a joke, David. But she said it was one of the most extraordinary books on Alzheimer's she's ever read. And she said, please don't tell David I didn't read it till now, but I guess it's too late for that, right?
Poor Mary Catherine. Everything she says is going to wind up on the radio one way or another.
I know. I'll be in the doghouse, but...
Yeah. Well...
I've become used to the couch, you know. It's not a bad place. My dog.
Of course, I'm glad you shared that, and you can damn well be sure that that's going to stay on the tape if I have anything to say about it.
No, but that's sincere. She said that. Trust me. Yeah, that's nice. Why I thought you'd find a way to use it.
That's it for our show today. Greg and I want to thank our colleagues at Cure Alzheimer's Fund, especially the chair of the research consortium, Dr. Rudy Tanzi, who was mentioned a few times. Of course, we want to thank our special guest, Kim Campbell, who was great to talk to, and I'm already hoping we can get her on again. At WCAI in Woods Hole, the engineer is Dan Treidel. Here in my apartment, the engineer is me. The Forgetting is a production of WCAI. Our producer is the great Sean Corcoran. And Greg, we'll talk soon, but you do still owe me that $100.
Oh, I'm going to fax it to you again, so don't worry about it. Do you need the interest?
Yeah, and the interest is creeping up these days, so, you know. So I'd get it to me sooner rather than later if I were you. It's just gonna cost you more.
All right, I'll go fax it right now. Sean will help me. God love you,
man. All right, love you. Talk
to
you soon.
Take care, brother.
Yeah.